Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I hope you're doing well in our tremendously different environment. People working from home and keeping physical distance from others, huge changes for us. And in a moment, we'll talk about what's going on in the San Francisco Bay Area with six counties where individuals have been instructed to shelter in place. We'll find out what that means and what the streets of those Bay Area counties look like this morning. But just to update you, in case you came in the middle of the D.C. news conference with President Trump, Vice President Pence, Anthony Fauci, epidemiologist talking about COVID-19, we just wanted to mention that the Trump administration is proposing a roughly $850 billion emergency economic stimulus to address the problem with the markets, and they're also considering ways of getting checks to American workers within a two-week period of time to help blunt the loss of income that so many Americans are experiencing right now. We'll keep you updated on that throughout the course of the day here on KPCC, and of course, with All Things Considered this afternoon. But let's check in on our fellow Californians in the San Francisco Bay Area. With us, health writer from the San Francisco Chronicle, Aaron Alde. Aaron, thank you very much for being with us. First of all, I don't know how much you've been out yourself this morning, but can you share with us just how communities in these counties look this morning?
So, hi. Thanks for having me, and good morning. I have not been outside. I'm sort of, for the most part, too busy, but also just, you know, we're told to stay inside, so I'm doing the best I can. I will say, you know, last night it was already starting to feel really quiet. I live in Berkeley, and I noticed it around here. What I'm hearing from my colleagues who are out sort of feeling things out in the real world, you know, there are still people kind of lining up for doing some shopping before they hunker down. Takeout places were getting a lot of crowds of people, you know, looking for food, maybe trying to hit up some last favorite spots that they fear are going to shut down over the coming weeks. So I think that there still is a fair amount of activity, but it still is mostly people sort of feeling their way through this.
You've got a combined population of about 6.7 million people. The counties are San Francisco, Santa Clara, San Mateo, Marin, Contra Costa, and Alameda counties. You've also got native counties that have not issued the same directive, Sonoma, Solano, and Napa counties. Is there a thought that they might be following suit?
You know, from what I hear, Sonoma may be kind of coming into the fold at some point this week. Their cases have been climbing slower than the rest, but they have been concerned. Napa County doesn't actually have any cases yet, and so they've been sort of removed from that a little bit. Solano County is interesting because they've had a few cases. In fact, Solano County had the notoriety of being the first place in the country to have, you know, an affirmed community-acquired case. But the health officer there has kind of taken a different tact, and he's sort of more interested in approaching this from, you know, getting the message out to people, you know, asking sort of the community, you know, on their own to self-isolate, and hasn't really put out the same level of mandates.
Aaron, what about exceptions to the shelter in place? What are things that are allowed for during this period?
So right now, there's a fair amount of flexibility in terms of how essential is defined. So, you know, any place where you can buy food or pharmaceuticals are all open. So grocery stores, pharmacies, and that's pretty broad. So, you know, liquor stores, Target, places, anything that has any sort of food supplies, those are all open at for right now. Restaurants are open as long as they only provide takeout or delivery. You know, veterinarians, auto body shops, gas stations, hardware stores. So places that people might need to access just to be able to live, you know, some sort of normal life are all staying open. The things that are shutting down are, you know, retail stores, businesses that don't provide some sort of essential, you know, living function. So I think, you know, right now in the places that the health officers that crafted this order, you know, they said point blank that they crafted this very quickly. They wanted to move very fast. And so I think that they even said that, you know, we're probably going to be coming up with some answers to these questions as the days pass.
If you're listening in one of the six counties in the San Francisco Bay Area, because I know we have a considerable number of listeners who listen online or via the app, share with us if you've been out even for a little bit to go to the supermarket or you had to go grab something at your office, something. Let us know what you're seeing if you live in one of the six counties. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or you can share on our AirTalk page at kpecc.org. Again, if you're a Bay Area listener to AirTalk right now, share with us what you're seeing if you've been out even briefly, and also just briefly share with us how you're complying with the shelter-in-place order for the six Bay Area counties. Aaron, I say it's very strange here at KPECC. We have only essential employees to get our local programming on the air in the building. So I pull into our garage. There's maybe one or two other cars. The rest, it's just completely open. Walking the lower floor, I'm confining myself to one floor, not going to our upper newsroom, just to sort of limit my contact. So quiet. Do you know if any of your colleagues are going in to the Chronicle building in San Francisco?
No, it's really weird. We were all ordered to work from home starting last Thursday. So we've been out of the newsroom, you know, for a few days now. Every now and then, a photographer or I think our editor-in-chief went back there for a short visit. You know, people have been stopping by to water plants and just, you know, they have things that they need to do there for a short time, but they'll usually post a photo or a video or something. And it's eerie. It's, you know, seeing this place that we all basically live in and that's usually just humming with activity to be just dead silent is definitely strange.
Yeah, it's so strange for all of us. Go to work, and in my case, because I need to be here to be on the air, leave right after the program, go home and isolate it. And it's just, it's still difficult, I think, for many of us to process how dramatically different our lives are right now. Aaron, this is probably too early to assess for you and your colleagues at the Chronicle, but I was wondering, in the wake of the shelter-in-place order, how many restaurants are actually just deciding to close down because they can't be profitable for them, or perhaps they're having trouble getting employees to even shift to a takeout model?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, that's something that is going to happen. I'm sure of it. My colleagues at this point are working already on, you know, coming up with lists of places that are planning to stay open, and kind of trying to do that as a service to readers to let them know where they can go. And I know other places like in San Francisco are putting together these lists. So I get the feeling that certainly a lot of places are going to try. I don't know how it's going to work out for a lot of them. You know, I have a friend who's a small business owner and runs a coffee shop, and I know that he's, you know, he's hoping to at least have some limited hours and be able to do takeout for just the neighborhood that depends on him. But yeah, the staffing thing, I mean, these things, these expenses add up. If you're not, you know, you're not making much money than, you know, from what you're used to, and you can't bring your employees in, then it's, you know, it starts to become a problem real fast.
Given that Silicon Valley is included in this, are all the tech companies, from what you've heard, essentially ghost towns?
You know, I think some of the big ones have been ghost towns for a while, and that a lot of them were like among the first to tell people to work from home. I mean, partly because they're tech, and so that's something that a lot of these places, they're used to that. They're used to folks, you know, telecommuting and just having that sort of environment set up. So I think that was part of it. But certainly now the rest of them seem to be doing that, to be sending people home and following along. We have heard of a few bad actors, and I don't have specifics yet. I know some of my colleagues are working on those stories, but a few businesses that are claiming to be essential and are insisting that people still come to work, and it's sort of like, you know, kind of iffy on whether or not they meet that criteria.
Aaron, I want to thank you very much. I appreciate your being with us and sharing with us what's happening up in the San Francisco Bay Area with the order in six counties to shelter in place. I hope we can check back with you in a couple days just to get an update on what's happening up there.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Erin Alday, health writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Just have the sentencing of former San Diego County Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter has been sentenced to 11 months in prison after pleading guilty to misspending his campaign funds on personal expenses. The former Marine and multi-term congressman, his defense team had asked for home confinement. But he has been sentenced to 11 months in prison following his guilty plea. Hunter resigned from Congress in January. He served six terms, representing one of Southern California's last solidly Republican districts. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. In just a moment, we're going to talk with a UC Irvine epidemiologist who'll be answering your questions about COVID-19. It's a service we're providing every day on Air Talk. Next hour, we're going to talk with students, K-12 and college students, about how their education is shifting to the home. But right now, I want to ask you from the bottom of my heart for your financial support for Air Talk on KPECC. And I say this with full knowledge that you may be in a situation where you're unsure where your next check is going to come from. Maybe you're a small business owner, you work in the gig economy, and things are feeling very insecure and very uncertain. And I understand that, I respect that, and we wish you all the best as you go through this. But if you're a listener who can financially support KPECC right now, I ask you to please do it. Our situation is this. We canceled our on-air member drive and the long interruptions that come with that so that we can bring you this in-depth coverage of the novel coronavirus. We still need to raise $1 million total over the course of this member drive, which extends through Friday. And right now, to help incentivize that process, our very faithful Southern California Public Radio board member Kathy Ward and George Ward, they are offering a $50,000 inducement to 300 people who contribute by 5 o'clock this afternoon. So please, we need your help right now. We have 195 people that we need to hear from by 5 o'clock. I ask you to please make your contribution right now. I'm going to close this shortly, and I'm sorry for interrupting to do it, but it is absolutely essential. Absolutely essential to the health of Air Talk and KPCC financially that we hear from you right now. 866-893-5722 or kpecc.org. I thank you. Thank you so much. And if you've already given, I hope you know how much you mean to us. We continue our conversation on COVID-19 every day. We have a noted epidemiologist joining us to talk about the latest understanding of COVID-19 and to answer your questions. True Today, UC Irvine School of Medicine, Professor of Medicine, Shruti Gohil. Dr. Gohil is Associate Medical Director for Epidemiology and Infection Prevention at the UCI School of Medicine. Dr. Gohil, thank you very much for being with us. First question that I have for you is just what we're learning over the past couple of days about the spread of the virus. Anything stand out to you about in terms of better understanding of its behavior?
Great question. You know, I think as the virus progresses throughout the world and in different spaces and places, you can see the different numbers. It's really hard to tell anything epidemiologically until we have a standardized sense of how many people are getting tested and what the criteria are for that testing. And so since that's defined differently in every sort of country and every sub location, it is difficult to get a handle on how this is going. That said, there are some really key things that we are learning that as the virus progresses we are seeing the verification of some of the numbers that we saw in China and in South Korea. I think the South Korean experience is probably the best in terms of knowing the large denominator of people who can get sick, and then how many actually get really, really sick enough to have to go to the hospital. So what we are experiencing here in the U.S. seems to approximate some of the numbers that we see in South Korea in terms of percentages of case fatalities, and Europe. I think if you look at some of the numbers coming out of Germany, the very low case fatality rates are encouraging, because the healthcare system that we have in place here, more or less, the expertise that's available when patients do get hospitalized can be approximated with some of the availability that we see in Europe as well. And that case fatality is about 0.4%.
0.4%. Okay, so lower than had previously been speculated.
For those that are healthy.
Yes. I wanted to ask you about reports of a second wave of coronavirus cases in countries that had seen the number of reported cases ebb. Singapore, Taiwan, Hong Kong, all three have seen a second wave with numbers bumping up. What are your thoughts about what's likely at play there?
Yeah, I think there are a number of things that can be at play. Obviously, when we put measures into place that allow for social distancing and keeping your people in the house, and then as we see our numbers come down and people feel more comfortable going out into communities, and awareness may be less present for keeping strict hand hygiene and that kind of thing, you might see that a resurgence of a viral spread. So I think that might be one of the factors at play. Certainly.
We're talking with epidemiologist, UC Irvine School of Medicine, Dr. Shruti Gohil. Again, our phone lines are open for you to call in with your questions for Dr. Gohil about COVID-19, the novel coronavirus. We're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPECC. And I think I might have misspoken earlier when I gave our member drive phone number. Let me give that again for you to make your contribution right now to leverage the $50,000 in the challenge. 866-888-5722, or you can make your contribution online or via the app, kpcc.org. Back in just 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. And if you're someone who has not been out much lately, you've so limited your physical contact with other people that you're feeling a little bit stir crazy, just want you to know you're in very good company and that we're with you in spirit, coming out of your personal assistant, your phone, your radio, however you're listening to us, your laptop. We're with you throughout the day here on 89.3 KPECC. We're talking with UC Irvine School of Medicine professor and epidemiologist Dr. Shruti Gohil. She's answering your questions about COVID-19 at 866-893-5722. Dr. Gohil, a couple days ago, I'm sure you saw this study, not yet peer-reviewed, but from the National Institutes of Health, in scientists analyzing the behavior of the coronavirus and indicating that on some harder surfaces, it can live for up to 3 days. It also looked at the behavior of the virus in the air. Your thoughts about what that study discloses and its limitations as well?
Yeah, great question. It's hard to translate what studies like that, when they are done in a laboratory or in a setting where you are looking specifically at questions about the hardiness of a virus, and translate that to the whole rest of the world in which we live. We know that cold viruses and flu viruses can also survive on environmental surfaces. And you have to step back and think to yourself, well, how is it that I catch a cold and how is it that I catch the flu every season? And it's very, very similar. So when you touch a doorknob, right, a handle, something that somebody else who could have been sick with something came and touched at the same time, there are two steps. You either are going to touch that, and then you're going to touch your nose and face and introduce it to a mucous membrane where the virus can get access to you and make you sick, or you breathe in a virus within a 3 to 6 foot orbit. This is not that different from what we experience with cold and flu. So in that same way, cleaning the surfaces that that you may touch after somebody you know who has been sick has touched is a really good idea. Washing your hands. That's why the CDC and many other professionals are recommending frequent hand washing. And that is because we know that we touch our face often. And we also know that we touch other things that others may have touched. And doing both of those type of strict hand hygiene and strict environmental control can really help mitigate your own risk.
You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. Larry Mantle with UC Irvine professor and Dr. Shruti Gohil. We have a question from Jennifer in the Fairfax District of LA. She does her clothes at a laundromat and is wondering, is it safe to go to a public laundromat with, you know, the public surfaces that are there to wash her clothes?
Great question. Parts to that question that I think there might be concerns over. There's the environmental surfaces that we just talked about. And how are you going to disrupt your risk when you come into contact with environmental surfaces? Simple, wash your hands. The second part that I hear in that question is the idea that other people's clothes could have been in the laundry and you put your clothes in and you're sort of concerned that your clothes can get contaminated by somebody else's who could have been sick. What's great news is that most viruses, I have not heard of a virus, let's say, that can survive the high heat of the drying cycle what we put through the washing machine with soap. So those two steps are absolutely critical. Everything that we know says that this is easily killed with simple laundry, and washing your hands to do a great job of killing the virus too.
All right, Jennifer, sounds like you can get your clothes clean. Thank you for that. Appreciate your call. Marcus in downtown Los Angeles, you're on Air Talk.
So my question for Dr. Gohil is, I am a healthcare provider. I work for Molecular Diagnostic Lab here in Los Angeles, and we're ramping up testing for the COVID-19, bringing that on. And we hope to ramp up shortly. However, as we know that testing has been very limited here in the U.S., and there's obviously going to be cases that are asymptomatic that we don't know. Based upon the infection rate of more informed nations such as South Korea or even based on a Chinese model, do we have a better estimate of the number of people who are truly infected? Are we able to make that kind of extrapolated guess, or is it just too far to say?
All right, Marcus, appreciate it.
Great question. It is really too early, I would say, in the United States to understand our numbers well enough. I do think that South Korea's experience helps us extrapolate a whole lot. Even in Europe, I think that the testing strategy and ramp up is still on its way to be ramped up like it is in the U.S. In other words, demand is surpassing the supply of testing. So until we are at steady state on that, it's hard to get the numbers. I hope I've answered your question.
We have Jeffrey, who asks on our Air Talk page, kpcc.org. In Taiwan, everyone is wearing masks. In fact, the Taiwanese government is heading the production of 6 million masks a day, produced at least 124 coronavirus response action items. Despite its proximity to China and a population density 6 times that of the U.S., Taiwan only has around 70 positive cases among a population population of just over 23 million and is not on lockdown like the U.S. because they are wearing masks and following the government's updates. Is it too late to implement some of Taiwan's containment strategies here in the U.S.? First of all, Dr. Gohil, is Jeffrey, to your knowledge, accurately characterizing what Taiwan's doing?
I think it is hard to say how Taiwan has mitigated its numbers. We have to also remember that the way that Taiwan approached things was to minimize who was coming into the country. It is away from mainland China. When you do that and limit travel immediately and early, and you put in these social distancing strategies right away, I'm not sure how much of it has to do with a face mask versus all of these other strategies. So hard to extrapolate.
Yeah. And can you comment on face masks? Because I know there are people who believe that helps to keep them safe. Do we have evidence that that's accurate, or is more of it that we pick it up from surfaces than airborne?
It's a melange of things. It's a really important question, so I'm glad you asked. It makes common sense. If, on the one hand, if you think about a barrier between your face and other people, and that it should lessen your risk, right? The thing is that it's not really clear that this helps people above and beyond the usual social distancing strategies and highly attentive processes to hand hygiene. So the two steps, breathing it in, second step, taking something that might be on your hand or a contaminated area, then introducing it to your mixed membranes. So face masks only help on the one, breathing it in part. But if you're doing social distancing, then you've mitigated that risk right away. And you have to kind of step back and think. In China, people were using face masks extensively all over China. We got thousands and thousands of cases, despite the use of face masks. So, it's not clear. The jury is out that it really makes that much of a difference if you don't do all of the right things, which are really about social distancing strategies. Now, if you are sick, you yourself are sick, you are sneezing, you got a runny nose, and you put a face mask, you are controlling your own source. That makes sense. If you are not sick, what I think could happen with a face mask is it gives you a false sense of security so that you're not doing all the other things that you ought to be doing to mitigate your risk, which is making sure that you're staying away from people and washing your hands.
James asks on our AirTalk Facebook page, if there's anything that should be done to try and sanitize one's pets.
Yeah, there have been stories out there talking about pet-mediated transmission. Obviously nobody's really studied this in any rigorous way to know whether or not that's a good thing to do. And it is true that if you have a pet and they happen to come into direct contact with secretions from somebody who is sick, just like you, just like humans, and then they come to you and they transfer it, sure, that can happen. But decontaminating your pet does not seem like a strategy that would be a high-yield strategy.
Kamanika in Altadena wonders if elective surgeries should be delayed until after COVID-19 abates.
Great question. Hospitals have been preparing for pandemics like this for years. We have contingency plans in place. And then when coronavirus comes into play, of course, we go into a mode of thinking about all innumerable things in the hospital. And of course, the operating room is one of them. There are two schools of thought. If you have a truly elective surgery, like you wanted to remove something that was bugging you on your skin, not something that it really matters for your health, then should you delay it? Sure. But elective can have a real big spectrum. Elective could also mean that you have a serious problem with one of your blood vessels. And while you don't need it immediately, like today, like an emergency, you should get it done within a week or two. Should you delay a surgery like that? Absolutely not. We have contingency plans in place, and we have ways to protect not just our healthcare workers, but our patients as well in the hospital. So I would not delay a necessary surgery, even though elective sounds elective. Sometimes that could be a gallbladder surgery that that your doctor has recommended you to get done sooner rather than later. I wouldn't worry about going in for a procedure like that.
Because one doesn't know, right, how long this could all last, and if it's something that it isn't emergency surgery, but still important to your health. If you delay now, I guess there could be cases, then it could be months, right, before maybe you'd get access to an OR.
That is absolutely right. And the other piece of that is that we are relatively early in our ramp up of cases, it is thought, because we don't have the testing there. We don't really know the extent. But so one could make the argument that right now might be a good time to get your surgery because things could be worse for all you know in a week or two or a couple of months. So there's two schools of thought.
We have Roy who asks on our AirTalk page. We're all, his family is his wife, he and his son are staying at home. Should we be frequently sanitizing doorknobs, counters, light switches? Is that something that they need to do throughout the course of the day?
Great question. If you are sick, some of these strategies really should be focused on who's sick and who's not. Who do you avoid and who do you not avoid? It's somebody who is sick in the house, you know it. They have secretions and they're touching doorknobs. They're all over the kitchen. That's a surface that you need to be cleaning periodically to make sure that other people don't pick it up. If you are all in the house, you're all healthy, nobody is sick, as far as you know, cleaning and sanitizing your spaces is not necessary, you know, with high frequency. If you introduce somebody into the house, you realize that they are sick or could be sick. Maybe you want to obviously clean through the surfaces that they've been in contact with.
Ed in Studio City says, why is it safe to eat takeout food if people preparing it and packing it aren't wearing gloves or face shields?
Great question. You know, we then have to step back to answer that question properly about what is it that we're trying to achieve as a society, as a community, when we close down restaurants, when we close down bars. We are trying to minimize the congregation of many people, some of whom could be sick. We as a public health and a medical community, we're trying to mitigate the potential sharing of surfaces, of sharing of plates, or handing off things to each other. When you'd order takeout, first of all, the food industry has standards on how you're supposed to manage food. They wear gloves when they're preparing it. They wear masks, hair ties and other things when they're preparing food. And that varies, of course, restaurant to restaurant. So then they prepare the food, they come over, and presumably, you know, one person who is not sick handing you food is not a problem. And again, your best barrier is when you have contact with anybody, you wash your hands, and wash your hands before you eat. Then you've mitigated that risk right there.
We're talking with epidemiologist Dr. Shruti Gohill, who's professor of medicine at the UC Irvine School of Medicine. She's associate medical director for epidemiology and infection prevention. She's generously spending most of this hour answering your questions about COVID-19 throughout the course of this emergency period. Each day, we've been very privileged to have a local epidemiologist answer these questions. We're at 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back in just 90 seconds. Seconds on Air Talk.
Our guidance yesterday urges Americans to take action for 15 days to help stem the outbreak. So it's a 15-day period. I guess now we'd say it's a 14-day period. It's 15 days from yesterday, and we're asking everyone to work at home if possible, postpone unnecessary travel, and limit social gatherings to no more than 10 people. By making shared sacrifices and temporary changes, we can protect the health of our people, and we can protect our economy, because I think our economy will come back very rapidly.
President Trump at the news briefing this morning, along with Vice President Pence, Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health, also part of that news conference. The president also said the White House looking at potentially mobilizing the Army Corps of Engineers to build field clinics and hospitals.
I'm going to work with a number of the governors. Governor Newsom has been very generous in his words, and I'm being generous to him, too, because we're all working together very well. And I think a lot of very positive things have taken place. We're talking to California about different sites, but we can have a lot of units up fairly quickly if we think we need them.
Just to update you on the latest California statistics, the state says there are 472 confirmed cases of COVID-19. There have been 11 deaths, including one non-California resident. And the age range of those who have confirmed positive, 300 of the cases are in the 18 to 64 age range. 160 cases are 65 and over. 7 cases are of minors, those under the age of 18. 5 cases, for some reason, are unknown. I guess they weren't able to get the age of the person who took the test. So just to give you a sense of what's happening here in California, we're joined by epidemiologist from UC Irvine, Dr. Gohill, joining us, Shruti Gohill with us. Dr. Gohill, your thoughts about the potential for field hospitals being opened. What do you think is the likelihood of the need for that kind of bed capacity?
By all projections, if you just take the numbers and if you think that the virus is going to march forward in the way that it has in other places, then those numbers would get big enough to require extra spaces to place patients. The likelihood of that, really, it's in the next couple of weeks. We hope that based on how things go in the United States, that we will know more. But it's really hard to predict the likelihood of needing something like that. You'll notice that in China, they had built hospitals, and I don't know that they really needed them at the end of the day after they put their strategies into place. As cases began to decline. But that's always a good thing to hope for. It's always really important to be planning as well.
The president talking about the next 14 days now, people not going out unless essential. We have a number of listeners like Nicholas in West LA wondering if they should go for their dental appointment, saying that in some cases the practices are open. My understanding, though, was the California Dental Association was recommending only emergency dental procedures be done. But Dr. Gohill, do you have any information on that?
I don't have any new information on that. But again, I think that some of the principles apply. It's true that dental work sometimes can be put off and it's not necessarily essential. So emergency does make sense. But then we start to ask the question, you know, how long can this be sustainable? And for which types of cases? And I think for the time being, that recommendation seems quite reasonable. It also helps our dental offices and other people not to be coming in and mitigating spread from that standpoint. So that, I think, is the underpinning of that approach. But if you have something that you need to get done and your dentist is open and able to work, then I would think that they would be able to have strategies in place, like cleaning their own surfaces. They'll be wearing masks. You'll be washing your hands. They'll be washing their hands. That safely you can do procedures like that. You just have to have the strategies in place to do it. We do it in hospitals and healthcare all the time.
I was going to say, probably about as sterile an environment as you'd be entering as your dentist's office these days. We also have, this is an excellent question, Un tweets at AirTalk. How do you recommend someone with symptoms, but untested, successfully isolate from family within the same house? What kind of cleaning or sanitizing needs to be done to keep other family members safe? And I would tag on to Un's question, should the person who is exhibiting symptoms stay in just one room of the house that other family members don't enter?
What a great question. It is important. So this stands for any viral illness or illness you think is communicable to somebody else in at home, and you have a loved one that you don't want to pass this on to. So what do? You separate yourselves from others as much as possible. You keep a 3 to 6 foot distance from other people as much as possible. Now, if you are sick, as I was saying before, now you're sick and you are a source you think is it's a respiratory illness. Yes, now that person should be wearing a face mask when you're in the same room as another person. That would be a reasonable strategy. And if you don't have a face mask, just any mouth covering and nose covering should be sufficient. And if you're unable to wear a face mask because it's uncomfortable and you have respiratory symptoms, your housemates can choose to protect themselves as well with a mask. You can stay in a different room from others in your home if that is an option. If available, use a separate bathroom. Don't share household items like utensils, drinking glasses, towels, bedding. Towels and bedding, of course, we don't think that the virus can survive very long. But of course, if you have a wet secretion on a towel and another person uses that same towel, well, obviously you might transfer, right? And then you wash your hands. The best, wash your hands right away with soap after you use anything that somebody else may have touched. And then you cover your cough and your sneeze with a tissue if you're in proximity with other people. Do you have to be completely locked down and not see anybody? That's not necessarily the case if you can actually avidly, strictly follow these types of strategies.
All right.
And then finally,
I
forgot to mention a really important key point. This is where those disinfectant wipes that your other listener was talking about come into play. Clean anything that you touch that others may touch.
All right. Rob writes on our AirTalk page, I work in a substance abuse treatment center. We've set up basins with a proper mix of chlorine water, cloth towel. Every hour or so, we glove up, wipe down doorknobs, chairs, sink handles, and flat surfaces. Chlorine water mixture, great way to quickly neutralize most pathogens. Just be sure to wear covering your old clothes in case you get the bleach on them. That's Rob sharing some information. You have anything else to add to that, Dr. Gohill, about, particularly since the wipes and the antibacterial solution are in short supply?
Yeah, it is true that listener is absolutely right that chlorine should work just fine. And I think that's all I would add. Yeah.
We're going to let you go. Thank you for spending all this time with us this hour. I can't imagine how busy you are, Dr. Gohill. We really appreciate your generosity with our listeners. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Shruti Gohill, Professor of Medicine and Associate Medical Director for Epidemiology and Infection Prevention at the UC Irvine School of Medicine. And again, in case you were not able to get through with your question, we obviously have many more questions than we have the time each day. Please save it. We'll be back with another epidemiologist or perhaps even Dr. Gohill tomorrow to answer your questions. Back in 1 minute on AirTalk.